This is the Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on June 16, 2000. Our speaker is Mark H. of San Jose, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Mark Hudson, and I am an alcoholic. How are y'all doing tonight? All right, good. It's been a while since I've stood up here and told my story from start to finish, and I really hadn't thought about it much. I talked to a few people about it. I had some great support tonight. People of this group took me out to dinner, and you know, I just feel very honored to be here tonight. So I'm going to do my very best to try to pass on the message that I heard when I got here. I'd like to welcome the new people that are here tonight. I didn't catch all the names, but if this is your first time to a meeting, please don't be offended by anything I say. Keep coming back. I was reading through the book the other day, and something really caught my mind, and it's something I think about a lot. And I just want to go straight to the book. It says, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of the trouble. So, you know, right now I just want to take this opportunity to thank all of you for scheduling your week around this hour to come and see me. Because this is about me tonight. I got to tell you, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous, what a blessing it been. You know, it was almost 10 years ago I walked into these rooms. I was not too happy about having to come here. It was a last desperate ditch effort to try to appease everybody else in my life to maintain my job. And, you know, and I did not want to come here. And almost 10 years later, I can tell you I'm so grateful that I'm here. I am so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, there's a lot of things about Alcoholics Anonymous that really touch my heart. And there's three things that really are very important to me. And they're not three original things that I thought of, but there are three things that I'd heard other people mention, and I've kind of incorporated them into my program. And the first one is to have a home group. Okay? Saturday Night Live is my home group. For those of you that are new, this is Saturday Night Live. What a home group means to me is it's not just a meeting where you go to and you show up and you sit in the back of the room, but it's a meeting where you go and you serve, you're visible, you're accountable to other people, and, you know, there's people there that know what's going on in your life on a daily basis. And that's what this group has been there for me. I mean, throughout my whole sobriety, I mean, we grow up publicly in this room. You know, it's not always pleasant, it's not always fun, but it's without that part of my sobriety, I would not have been able to last the almost 10 years that I've been here. So if you don't have a home group, I suggest you get one. The book talks about getting a sponsor. Sponsorship is very, very important. I've had three different sponsors since I've been here, and each sponsor I had something at the time I wanted. And I always have maintained a relationship with a sponsor and contacted them. So that's another very important part of my life. The third is to have a sobriety date. Now, I went to rehab center on February 9th, 1991. But my sobriety date is February 10th because I had to have a few cocktails in order to get the courage to make it down there. So that was my sobriety date, February 10th, 1991. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, a pill, or a fix since then. I didn't say I didn't feel like it, because I did many times. I felt like taking a drink a lot of times in that first year. But I just put one foot in front of the other, and I had a home group. So when I walked into the rooms, people could tell something was wrong with me. I had a sponsor, so I had somebody to call. That's why those three things are very crucial, because they saved my life. If it wasn't for those three things and the program behind it, I wouldn't be here tonight. So I really encourage you to think about those three things in your life and find out if you have them. Maybe it's not something that'll work for you, but they work great for me. I was going to tell you a little bit about my story and how they talk about what it was like, what happened, and what happened now. You know, I was at home the other night with my girl, and we were sitting around talking, and there on the table in front of me is a family history. that my aunts and mom had spent years and years putting together. And, you know, out of curiosity, she opened it up to see what it said about me. It's a pretty dangerous thing to have your family history sitting right there in front of you. And I hadn't looked at this document in a long time. You know, I kind of put it out there. It's a coaster. You know, I'm just going to lay it out there and kind of look at it. First thing she wanted to do is find me in there. I got to tell you, this is my story right here. And it kind of caught me off guard when she started to read it, because this is how my family saw me. This is what my family knew me as. Now, this is probably a year or 6 months after my sobriety finally got done. And I was just going to read you a part of what my family saw me like, because that's part of my story, and I'll get to that part here in a minute. But this is kind of what my family saw me like, and this is what my story is in a condensed version. It says, Mark was born in February 14th, 1961. He's the only child of Ida and Wayne Hudson. At the time, they lived in Livermore. When Mark was about six, the Hudsons sold their house and moved to Castro Valley, where Mark attended grade school. Pretty normal so far. The Hudsons moved to Newark. This is where it begins. When Mark was in eighth grade, Mark went to Newark High School. He lettered in basketball, track, football, playing tight end and linebacker. At graduation from Newark High in 1979, Mark was offered football scholarships at St. Mary's, Long Beach, and Santa Clara University. He had carried a 3.8 GPA, but was unsure what he wanted to do with his life. It was like a normal childhood. Came from an upscale family. Everything's going good. Mark chose to go to Hayward State, went there during the day, and he worked full-time at night. This is where it starts. Several things happened during this time that made Mark lose his focus. Geez, I wonder if we can all guess what that is. Well, the story says the store went non-union, and I got laid off. His interest in school waned, and as he was sharing a house with several other boys, and partying became more important. He started drinking heavily and was introduced to cocaine sometime during this stage of his life. This is my family history about me. That's fucked up. Wayne and Ida sold their home in Fremont and rented a home there until Wayne retires in 87. Let's see if you can relate to this. Several times Mark would move back home only to move out and try something else, but never addressing the issues of alcoholism. By this time, Mark had a severe alcohol and drug-related problem. Hiding the problem and supporting his habit became Mark's lifestyle for the next several years. Well, he moves from one job to another and relationship to relationship. And then here's the quote, Adam. He says, when dealing with drugs and alcoholism, getting a job never is the problem. Holding one is. That was my take on it then. Then it goes on to talk about my bottom, and I'll share that in my story. But Mark was working for Safeway in a management position. Let's see if you can relate to this next line. His pattern of not showing up for work was starting to show, and one of his managers called him and asked him if he had a drug problem. Oh, no, not me. He finally admitted he did and was told the union he belonged to had access to a drug problem. So I entered a 30-day program because I was confronted. I had no other choice. And this is the part where it started changing in my life. You know, that's kind of sad when I opened that up and she read that the other night, and that's my family history. And, you know, ironically, we started reading some of the other pages, and guess what? I'm not the only alcoholic in the family. Alcoholism in my family goes back way back, all the way back to my great-great-great-grandfather. You know, and I know the book doesn't say whether or not it's inherited or not, but there's a part in the book it talks about why some people get it and some people don't. And for the life of me, I've heard Keith O. share it many times, you know, especially with his brothers and the things that have happened in that area, why he got it. And I don't know. I was thinking about that today, and, you know, and I just got warm and fuzzy. I felt so grateful that for some reason I got it. But when I was reading the front page of this, and I'll share this and I'll get into my story, because I thought this was interesting stuff, because this is kind of a pattern in my life, too. It talks about my great-great-grandfather. And talks about my great-great-grandfather, my great-great-grandmother, and this is my aunt speaking. She says, I began to admire Grandma Cook, who had died when I was about 11. Grandpa Cook was an alcoholic who, before my mother was two, had an affair with another woman. Grandma and Grandpa Cook divorced and went their separate ways. Grandpa Cook married another woman, and Grandma Cook took care of the kids. This is the insanity of what goes on in alcoholism, going all the way back to when? 8 years later, he divorced that second wife and he remarried his first wife. That's insanity. Trust me, I know. You know, that actually made me feel better about my life when I read that today. I didn't go that far. You know, I can recall my first drink only because it was brought up in such a humorous way that it brought me so much attention in my life. I was 3.5 years old, and my parents had had a cocktail party. I guess that was the end thing to do. And while everybody was dancing, I made my way around the table and proceeded to drink everybody's martinis. Again, I don't remember any of this, but the story was told to me years and years and years, in and out, family gatherings, you know, and it always got me attention. And I related that the attention I got with the drinking. Apparently, I drank everybody's martinis, and when they found out I had drank them, my dad had to put me in the car. And here's, I'm 3.5, and he's driving around with my head hanging out the window of the car, throwing up all over the car. You know, that's attractive. I want attention. I'm willing to go to any lengths to get that attention. So as my family shared that story with me at numerous occasions, I became the center of attention. A little bit of history I read about here about my lifestyle. When I was growing up, everything was kind of normal in my family, although both my parents had been married and divorced before. My dad had 2 children. My mom had 2 children. They remarried and had me with the whole intention. There was no pressure on me, mind you, but the whole intention of having me was to bring the other children closer together. So that's what they did, and it worked. It worked. The kids came together. They spoiled me rotten. They had a pretty normal childhood. It wasn't until that traumatic move from one city to another at that adolescent age where we're all uncomfortable with ourselves that I remember feeling really uncomfortable and drinking became a part of my life. I had moved to a new city and a new location and I desperately wanted to fit in. I was now a small fish in a big pond and I didn't know anybody and it was summertime. I can remember this vividly. I'd met the neighbor kids and what they did is they drank. And so I pretended like I knew what they were doing. And we would go and sit down. It was Miller High Life they were drinking at that time. And we go, and the way they drank was you take a beer and you drink it, and then you sit it down and you have to line them up as fast as you can. And you each have, you know, at least a six-pack. That was my first experience that I recall that I, you know, voluntarily drank without knowing what it was going to do to me. And I puked my guts up, man. I was sick as a dog. But you know what? I had friends now, and I was becoming a part of. And that's what I was after. So that's what I did. I instantly fit in. No problem. Both my parents worked, so when school started, guess where all the parties were? Mark's house. You know that kid that your parents says you can't go play with? That's me. Nothing much happened to me over the next few years as I began to drink. You can see from what I read that I managed to get through high school and carry good grades. I could hide my alcoholism. I excelled in sports. I excelled in school. Pretty normal childhood. My mom, on the other hand, was a pretty smart lady. My mom knew everything that was going on in my life. And she knew I had a problem. She found my marijuana one time. She found my alcohol. She took it and she didn't say anything. But she never told Dad because my dad was a raging alcoholic himself. And many times I'd seen my dad get violent with my mother as growing up as a child. Still vivid memories in my mind. But my mom protected me in that way. You know, she always was there for me. You know, and when she would confront me, I would feel bad. And, you know, I'd want to try to change and be a better person. And those things are vivid in my mind growing up. I also remember once she stole my pot. I went looking for it, and I found it in her drawer and took it back. You know, and I was just thinking about that the other night. I wondered if she was going to smoke it. Why would she keep it, you know? I don't know. I'm going to ask her about that. I'm going up there to see her this weekend. She'll probably laugh. But see, I can talk to my mom now. I can talk to my dad. So after I got out of high school, this is where things started really getting rough for me. As I read earlier, I had 3 full-ride scholarships to play football. 3.8 GPA, smart kid, doing pretty well. Again, I've been kind of feel a little immature at my age. I had brothers and sisters, but they had all gone. My nearest brother's 10 years older than me, so I was kind of an only child. My parents worked. I didn't feel real mature at that age. I always managed to work, and I was always determined to do well. As soon as I graduated high school, my parents decided they were going to sell their house. That kind of freaked me out. what was I going to do? And, you know, they put the house up for sale. They figured it wouldn't sell for a while, and a month later it sold, and they moved off to the mountains and retired. I'm 18 years old. I got no direction because I can't talk to my father because he's an alcoholic. My mom's tried to tell me what to do, but she's got her own things going on, you know? So what do I choose to do? I'll go to Cal State Hayward. Fuck the scholarships. The only reason I picked that school, by the way, is there's a bar dead center in the campus. I went and checked that out first thing. And I moved in with a bunch of guys, and we began partying. And in order to fit in, once again, the key to what's going on in my life, I had to drink. So we began drinking 6-7 nights a week, going out to bars every night. We worked together, we drank together, we partied together. But for some reason, I partied just a little bit more than anybody else during those days. And it was apparent to me that I had a little bit more of a problem than they did. But I just, you know, they would always every once in a while say, you know, Mark, maybe you should cool out. I'm fine, leave me alone. This went on for a number of years, and they moved on, got relationships, got married, settled down, became normal people, and I was still doing what I was doing. And that's what happened for me. I just continued to drink, and when my friends turned their backs on me, or I got in trouble with the law, I'd call Mom and Dad. Mom and Dad would bail me out. So I started doing a lot of different things that we do and the book talks about. I started doing some geographics. You know, there were those little Honda Civics, those when they first came out, those little tiny cars? I managed to fit all my belongings into one of those and moved up to Sacramento. Okay, I'm going to move to Sacramento. Things are going to be different up there. And I moved up to Sacramento, and, you know, the same pattern would go on and on. I'd get a new job. I'd settle in. I'd start doing well. I'd meet a new girl. I'd have a new relationship. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, the girls I went out with didn't drink because, you know, then I didn't have to share that way. So everything would be going fine, and 3-6 months into it, the same thing would happen. I'd be coming crashing and burning down. It was just a pattern that went on. I'd be out there drinking, and, you know, she'd confront me, and I'd tell her to fuck off and, you know, and move out. I'd lose the job because I didn't show up, and I'd move to another town. It wasn't a real glamorous life. I mean, I've heard people get up here and share their stories, you know, and they're humorous. Mine isn't that humorous. It was just, that's how my life was for years. Years and years and years. Now, I could tell you some funny stories about drinking during those times, you know, but that's not what I'm here to talk about tonight. Yeah, there were some good times during those times. I had a lot of fun. Obviously, I had fun. Otherwise, I wouldn't quit drinking. One of the moves took me back up to where my parents had retired. And at the time, I got to meet one of my brothers that I had never met before. And this is a brother from my dad's first marriage who happened to be an ex-Hell's Angel. I never met the guy before, and, you know, and he took me under his wing, and he was staying up there too. He was watching my parents' place because they were traveling around the United States in a big motorhome. They were retired. It was a great opportunity to move home. They weren't going to know I was there. So I went on up there, and got to meet my brother, and that was fun. We began to drink together and do drugs together, and you know, things got really crazy really quick, and it was kind of a blur to me for the next 6 months, but. I know I had a job. I know I didn't go a lot to it. I was an outside sales rep, and I didn't have to go to an office or anything. And I remember going to some of the seediest bars that I'd ever seen and doing some really, you know, seedy things that you do when you go to those bars. And probably 8 months later, my parents came back from their trip. And I was out one night, and I came home after they got back, and there was my brother and my mom, my dad, sister, my two other brothers, and a couple of aunts sitting there waiting for me when I walked in. I didn't think much of it. Everybody came to visit Mom and Dad. My brother, the ex-Hell's Angel, thought I had a problem with drugs and called the whole family. This guy's an ex-Hell's Angel, and he's calling and saying, I think you got a problem with drugs. I partied with him. He called the whole family together. They did a big family confrontation. Now, I don't know if you've ever experienced one of those, but it's not real fun. It's not like a family get-together, you know? And you know, I was very defiant. I don't have a problem. And, you know, I got very backed up. You know, when we get confronted as an alcoholic, what we do is we put our back up against the wall and we try to fight our way out. And I was fighting my way out for a while. But, you know, I really didn't have any place to go or anything to do. So I caved in, and they had already done some research, and there was a local meeting to go to. I said, fine, I'll go every Tuesday and Thursday night whether I need it or not. Just leave me alone. My brother offered to go with me. I said, I can handle it by myself. Tuesday night, I went down, found the nearest bar, sat there for an hour and a half, came back, said the meeting was great. Don't think I'll do that anymore. I did that for about a month and a half before my parents, you know, realized what was going on, and my brother And it got to the point where my family had to disown me. My family would not do anything more to help me. Over the years, they had bailed me out of jail. They had bailed me out of financial ruin. They had moved me from one place to another. I can't tell you how many times they bailed me out. I can tell you this, though. My mom can tell you because she kept track of every dime I ever borrowed from her. And I'll get to that point. I'm still paying on that one. So here I am. I got no job, no place to live. Probably 23 years old. Family's disowned me. Nobody will help me out. I do what any good alcoholic would do. I go find another girl and take a hostage. That's what I did. Moved down to Sacramento, found another hostage, moved in with her, got a job where she worked, proceeded to ruin her life. That didn't work out. Moved across town, got another place, another girl, another job. Now this job, I'll tell you a little bit about this job. I stole a lot of stuff from this job. This was Pennzoil. And I stole truckloads of oil from this place so I could support my drinking habit. And I remember going out one night with one of the guys, and I was one of the best salespeople they had there. And they had a company car and a whole pit. I mean, I could talk my way into anything. When you need a drink, when you need it, not when you want it, but when you need a drink, you'd be amazed at what extent you'll go to get that and how smooth you can be. And I could talk my way into anything. And I'd gotten this job being a sales rep for Pennzoil and had keys to the warehouse and the whole bit and company car. Things are going great. New girlfriend, new place, making lots of money. And I took this new guy out who desperately wanted to get into sales, and we went out one night to go have a few drinks. Now, I don't know about you, but when you're out drinking, I like to kind of brag about things. So I had told him how I got the job was I had lied. I didn't have a license. I had, you know, kind of stolen somebody else's name and identity and obtained a license that way, and I really wasn't who I was. And I was quite proud of it. Next day I walked in and they terminated me, and I couldn't figure out why for a while. But the guy wanted my job better than I did, so that's what happened. So one more time, I looked around for a job. And I got to tell you, the next job that came along was my dream job. I was living in Sacramento. They were looking for a sales rep down here in San Jose. The company flew up to Sacramento to interview me. I found the last suit I had, and I went down and met this company. Managed to get sober for a day and a half, whatever. Showed up and interviewed with this company, and they were looking for an outside sales rep, and you wouldn't guess what they wanted me to sell. They wanted me to sell alcohol and wine. And I said, yeah! I tell you, when they showed up, you know, they were talking to me and going over things, and they had this wooden briefcase with them, and I can recall talking and listening to them, telling them all the things they wanted to hear to get the job, and they opened up this wooden briefcase. It'll be part of your selling tools, Mark. My eyes lit up. Like a little kid at Christmas. This wooden briefcase, and it held two or three bottles of wine, four glasses, and had the corkscrew. And I was in awe. I had arrived. Finally, a job that I was qualified for. I could have actually put that on my resume, and it wouldn't have been a lie. So I didn't even care what they paid me. I took the job. Job was back down here in San Jose. That's what brought me back down here. I was in Sacramento at the time. They hired me. And they said, okay, well, you're going to start in about 30 days. Ooh, 30 days to party. So I remember this. This was kind of another bizarre event. I stayed in that apartment literally for almost 30 days, hardly ever leaving, drinking and doing drugs the entire time. Mind you, I had a pretty nice house, a pretty nice apartment. My parents had one more time taken care of that, and couches, furniture, the whole bit. It looked like a normal person lived there, except for it was always the shades were drawn and, you know, up real late. Well, you know, I kept saying, well, I'll pack up things the next day. I'll do this, I'll do that. I never did. It got down to the night before I was supposed to report to work. I had a whole apartment full of people, furniture, bed. You know what I did? I left all that shit there. I just got in my car and left. I never told them I was moving out. I never said anything. I left everything there. Couches, I took clothes I needed and I left. You know what? And the odd thing is that seemed normal to me. That really, it'll be here. I mean, it'll be there when I need it. I'll come back later. And I moved back down to San Jose, and I got a job as a wine salesman. And I proceeded to drink every day from morning, noon, and night, and I could justify it because that's what they were paying me to do. I quickly rose to the top salesman in that company, and you can imagine why. I didn't have a problem selling alcohol. I could sell a lot of that stuff. And, you know, it was great. I had Santa Cruz as my territory, San Jose, Monterey. I mean, you know, I was living the lifestyle. And I started drinking, going out and drinking with my clients and, you know, doing different things. And pretty soon, one more time, I stopped showing up to work. Before you knew it, it was 3 weeks before I'd even left the house, still drinking. But, you know, the odd thing is I was still the number one salesman for the company. I could get on that phone just hammered out of my mind and call up and place orders and do everything I needed to do. Just still a functioning alcoholic. I met another girl at that time. I don't know what happened there. It got pretty ugly. Somehow I ended up in jail. I was drunk in public. They arrested me at my own house. I don't know how that one worked, but they got me. Drunk in public in my own house. They took me in. I lost my job. Lost the dream job, and I didn't know what I was going to do next. So I resorted back to the grocery business, which is what I always knew. I had been in the grocery business all throughout high school. I had three jobs when I was in that high school student with the 3.8 GPA and the college scholarships. I mean, I look back on it and I said, what happened to me? What happened? I had everything going. I tell you, for the longest time, I blamed my parents for not giving me any guidance, because it's easier, you know, to point the finger at somebody else than to look at our own choices. I got back in the grocery business, and as you read, when I read earlier, that's where I was when I had hit my bottom. But what you didn't hear about is where it actually took me. I had been at that store for a while, stealing money so I could support my habit. It had actually given me the keys to the safe. Big mistake. I was working at Safeway, and they have a milk box in the back, and I would hide my alcohol there. And that's what I'd do. I'd come in at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I'd go back there and drink my vodka, and I'd stock the shelves, and, you know, if they called me up to check, I'd go up and check, and I'd do all the crank I needed to do. And this is what I did. This was a normal work day. This is what I had to do to get through work. And I did that for quite a while before it became noticeable. Now, what had happened is I had lost the apartment I was living in because I was spending all the money I could on alcohol and drugs. And I was too ashamed to tell anybody about it. And I didn't have any place to go because my parents had already turned their back on me. My family didn't want anything to do with me. So what I did is I found myself a nice little cardboard box out behind Long's, and that was my home. And that's where I lived before I got here. I didn't tell anybody about it because I was a little bit embarrassed, but, you know, I was quite comfortable there. I was more willing to spend the money on alcohol and drugs than I was to go find a place. It wasn't that I didn't have a few dollars. I did. That's what's really sick, but I was not going to spend that, waste that money on a place. All I was going to do was sleep there. So I ended up living in a cardboard box behind Long's up in Mountain View. And I was there for a couple of weeks, and I don't know what happened. It's kind of different stories been told to me. I remember I had different work schedules and different hours because I was in the union, and apparently I'd gone to work one day in a blackout and told him to fuck off, quit my job. Bad thing about doing something in a blackout is when you go back the next day, you don't tend to remember that stuff. And I felt really foolish walking in the next day to show up for my scheduled shift. Everybody kind of looked at me strange. And they said, well, we need you to go home and come back and talk to the manager. Little did they know where I was going to go. My home was a bar. That's where I went. I wasn't in a bar. I was in my cardboard box. I often have told people that I cut a little window on the top of that. It was a refrigerator box, long one, so you could lay in there and sleep. And I would cut a hole in there so I could, you know, romantically gaze at the stars. The truth of the matter is you can't hold a bottle upside up like that when you're laying upside down in a cardboard box. I had to cut a hole so I could tilt the bottle up. Let's see, one more time, I had to even romanticize a cardboard box because the book talks about it. We seek the lower companionship. You know, I can make anything sound good if I want to. I'd been living in this cardboard box for a couple of months, been fired from my job or quit my job in a blackout, not quite sure. And I had a few dollars left over from last paycheck, whatever I had stolen from the till the night before, and I managed to stay afloat for a couple of months. I'd go and steal from the liquor stores, and I'd grab a shower at the Y if I could. If you left something in your car, I'd steal it. I did whatever I needed to do to get what I needed. And I'll tell you what, I was completely happy where I was. I didn't know any better. I didn't know that life was supposed to be different. I was completely comfortable with where I was. And had I not been confronted, had I not been, somebody noticed that I had a problem and stuck their hand out, I might not be here today. But for the grace of God, there go I. What happened is one more time I showed up to beg and plead and borrow and see if I could get my job back, and the manager asked me to come in and talk to him. I found out years later that he's a member of this program. and he knew I had a problem. And I was coming up on my 30th birthday. 30th birthday, I figured I'd be dead. So I went into his office, and I was confronted by him and the assistant manager, and they asked me if I had a problem, and I continually denied it. I realized I didn't really have any choice, so I admitted I had a drinking problem. And they said that you're a member of the retail clerks union, and they'd be happy to send you to a rehab center if that's what you'd like to do. I thought about it for a while. I had lots of choices. Let me see, cardboard box, rehab, I don't know. I was coming up on my 30th birthday, and I pleaded and borrowed with a guy, could I think about it for 3 or 4 days? I was going to go out on one more run, and then I'd go in. That was my thinking, just let me get a couple more days in. Obviously, he knew what my thinking was, and he said, you need to make a decision right now, or else we can't help you. What was I going to do? I went ahead and said, okay. And a big relief came over me. A big weight came off my shoulders. Because you know what? I knew I was done. I knew I was done doing cocaine. I wasn't going to done. I wasn't stopping drinking. That wasn't a problem. I was going to stop doing cocaine. I'll go down there and learn how to not do cocaine and drink successfully. That's what I'll do. And that's what I was going to do. So they checked me in, and it was going to be a few days before I went in, and I actually called my family and explained to them what was going to go on in my life and what decisions I had made. And much to my surprise, they weren't surprised that I had ended up where I was, and they were very happy I was going to go into this program and offered to come down and drive me down there. My brother offered to let me stay at his house for a few days, so I did. And I stayed at his house, and his son had a few drugs there that night, so for the next few nights I drank and partied with him, getting ready to go to rehab. Sister drove me down. We stopped at Spoon's over in Hamilton on the way down to Scotts Valley, and I downed my last 6 beers before I could get the courage to go down there. And I got down to rehab, and I'm scared. Now, mind you, I'm going down there with the mindset that I got a problem with drugs. Drinking has never crossed my mind that there's a problem with drinking. And they do the intake on me, and they look at me, and they ask you all the right questions, and they say, when was your last drink? And when I looked at my watch, I thought they were going to ask me to leave. But they didn't. They kept me there. The union was paying for it. They weren't going to kick me out. So my second introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous is now going to be in a 30-day treatment center. And I'm scared to death down there. And for the next 2 weeks, I go through the regime. I'm going to fake it until I make it, do whatever I have to do. They got you going to meetings. They got you, working one-on-one with somebody. All the stuff that, AA teaches you for free, basically. I wasn't going to quit drinking. I was dead set against quitting drinking. I was just going to get clean, stop doing coke. I'm going to stay down there for a month. I'm going to come back. I'm going to get my job back. Everything will be fine. Then I had an awakening. I had a spiritual experience, unlike what the book talks about, because it was almost a white light experience for me. I was sitting in a room, 4 other guys in this room, and the guy next to me in the bed next to me is kicking heroin. I never did any heroin. I didn't relate to this guy at all. He wasn't like me at all. But he was in bad shape. And I was laying in my bed at night, and something just came over me, and I knew at that moment that I could no longer take a drink. I knew from that very moment that I could no longer take a drink. What a blessing that was. I don't know what happened. I don't know how those two things relate, but God was obviously working in my life. For the next 2 weeks, as I stayed in that program, I knew that I wasn't going to drink anymore. I can recall sitting in one of the meetings, and there was 35, 40 of us, and they said, 1 to 2% of you will make it. The rest won't. Now, everybody inside was saying, that's going to be me. I ended up going back years and years, one year after another, and nobody made it. I was still the only one sober. And I don't know if it was because of the experience I had there, or it was because of the fact that I got involved with such a great group, or because I got the sponsorship or needed, or because I did the things I needed to do. But I'm really glad it was me. That's all I know. Got out of that program, and I checked myself into a halfway house. And I lived in this halfway house for the next 7 to 8 months. It was suggested to me. My pride and ego didn't want to go there, but I did anyways. I was taking direction for the first time in my life. My family had actually come to see me when I was in rehab. And we were beginning to rebuild that bridge already. And I found a halfway house that was suitable to me. It was co-ed, and it was in Saratoga, so I thought I'd move right into that. I mean, if I'm going to be sober, I'm going to have some fun. And Saturday Night Live at the time was over at El Paseo across the street here, and we, as members of this house, had to go to a meeting a day. And I got out, and the boss at the store gave me my job back. Gave me the job back, and he put me in charge, gave me the keys to the safe again. You insane? So, here I have a place to live, got my job back, my parents bought me a car. Of course, I didn't have a license or insurance, but, you know, I hadn't hooked up with a sponsor yet and figured out that was wrong. So I lived in this house for 7 months, and I went to Saturday Night Live. And I got to tell you, I walked into Saturday Night Live, and it scared the living shit out of me. It actually, it still does to this day, but not as bad as it did back then. And I walk in awe, and I'd watch the people. And the first thing that crossed my mind is, who's keeping these people accountable for their sobriety and their date? Because, I mean, that's an obvious. I mean, yeah, we're alcoholics. We drink, and we're telling each other we've been sober for a year. Bullshit. Who's watching? Who's the president? Show me what's going on here. So I sat in the back room, and I watched, and I was just in awe, and I'd go sometimes 2-3 meetings a day because I wasn't working that much, was just working part-time. And I tell you what scared me more than anything was that about halfway through the meeting, I knew that I became very important because the book says selfishness and self-centeredness that we think are the root of our problem. I knew I was so important that I stood out so much that I was probably going to be the next person they were going to call on. You know, I'm new. I'm looking like I got it together back there. I'm sure they're going to call on me. There's 200 people in this room. They're going to call on Mark. They don't even know me. I'm not introducing myself to them, but I have to leave the room because I'm paranoid that I'm going to have to get up there and talk. My greatest fear was having to come up at this damn podium with this damn microphone and talk. So halfway through just about every meeting, I had to leave. And that's terrible that I went through that. So what I figured I'd do, as any good alcoholics, I'd figure I'd find the in crowd. I've been going to this meeting for 7-8 months now. And I took one of the guys that I was living with at the halfway house, and we actually went and rented an apartment together. And I hadn't found a sponsor yet. Well, I asked the guy to be my sponsor, but I don't think I ever called him. But if I got asked if I had a sponsor, oh, yeah, I got a sponsor. No problem. Got that covered. I had my $10,000 big book from when I went to the rehab center, and that was collecting dust. I was working a little. I was managing to pay the bills, and parents had bought me a car. Yeah, okay, this sobriety thing's not too bad. You know, at least I got places to go, and I'm not sleeping in a cardboard box and giving me my job back. What the hell? So I'd gotten just a little over a year, I guess, and that's when the idea popped in my mind that if I just got in with the right crowd, you know, maybe I could, you know, make things happen. So that's when I spotted her from across the room. I just celebrated a year, so I knew I was fair game. Because in case you don't know, if you're new, yeah, usually we have to wait until you have a year before we can ask you to go out to coffee. So 6 months later, a year later, her and I got married. Well, first, let me go back here. For the next 6 months, I was in a relationship with somebody who was a very visible member of this group, had quite a bit of time. I had about a year. She had about 10 years. I saw her as the in crowd. This was what I was going to do. I was going to become part of the crowd, and that way I could blend in, and I wouldn't have to get called on to come up here and speak at the podium because I'm with the A crowd. So that's what I was going to do. I mean, that's what we do. That's what I've done all my life. I just want to fit in. When I was moving to that new city, and I just wanted to fit in, what did I do? I did what they did. When I left high school, I did what my buddies did because I wanted to fit in. When I went to work, I did what they did because I wanted to fit in. This time, I'd come to AA, and I was still practicing old behavior. I did what they did because I wanted to fit in. And so I started dating this young lady, and I was in with the in crowd, and I started meeting a lot of the same people that are in this room today. A lot of the in crowd is still here. They're kind of the older crowd now. And our relationship was the typical alcoholic relationship that I've seen here. It was pretty rocky. And I tell you, though, if you're new here and you haven't done your steps or you don't have a sponsor, there's nothing like a relationship with another alcoholic that will drive you to the big book. Because the first time that relationship hit a rock bottom, and there were many more to come, but the first time that one hit a rock bottom, I hooked up with my sponsor, and he sat me in a room, and I did all the steps that night. I was up all night. I was in so much pain. I was either going to drink or I was going to figure out what the problem was. And lo and behold, guess what the problem was? It was me. It wasn't her, it was me. And that's my experience with the first 12 steps that I did. And I had 18 months sober when I did them. I don't suggest that's the way you do it, but that's my story. A little while later, that young lady and I got married, and I realized I now had to support not only myself, but a family, and that I needed to get busy and start earning money. And several opportunities came my way, and I got busy. The book talks about money, property, and prestige. And I got to share with you this part of my story because it's very important that you hear this. I had probably 3 years of sobriety at this time, 3 or 4 years of sobriety, and I no longer found it necessary to come to these rooms. You see, I had gotten it all together. I now had a job that I was successful at. I now had a wife, a place to live. Thank you very much for everything you've taught me. I'm fine. For the next 8 to 12 months, I did not come to any meetings. I worked 6 days a week, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, and I was buying things and saving money and trying to get ahead as fast as I could. And around me, my life was crumbling, and I was oblivious to it. That's what I did. That's what the disease did. I changed addictions from alcohol to work. And I was chasing the big bucks. And when all that came crashing down on me, I did the about face. And one day, and came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't find it necessary to drink during that time. But I can tell you the insanity of all the past years were right there. My behavior was insane. My life was insane. It was no better than living in the cardboard box. But I just wasn't coming to meetings. I wasn't taking anything, but I wasn't coming to meetings. And I got to tell you, it was a humbling experience to walk back into these rooms. And I'll tell you what was the greatest experience when I walked back in is that many of the same people that are here tonight were there. And they welcomed me with open arms and were glad to see me. And they didn't judge me. They asked me how I was and what they could do to help. And I began to get involved with the program again. And I began to go to meetings. And I began to become of service. Secretaried meetings. I got involved with events. Now, the damage I had done in that relationship was damage I had already done. There's nothing I could do about it but to try to change my behavior. But as a result, the relationship ended and the wife and I separated. We did that for quite a while. We got back together. We separated again. We got back together. Well, same old story. We ended up getting divorced finally. Well, almost divorced. We're almost there. I got to tell you, if it wasn't for these rooms, I don't know if I could have made it through some of the things I made it through. I mentioned my family and how I had gotten disowned. When I had worked through the steps that night with my sponsor, he said, "You need to make amends to your family." And I went to make amends to my mom, and they were accepting of my amends. And I went to make the financial amends, and I said, "I know I've taken a lot of money from you and a lot of your time and a lot of your energy, and I don't know how to make it right, but I want to start paying you as much as I can until I've done that debt." When I mentioned my mom and kept track of every dime, she pulled out a file this thick. And she said, "Oh, I kept track. I know exactly how much you owe." Gee, thanks, Mom. I've been sober almost 10 years now. I send them money every month. I've bought them a car. I haven't finished yet. I don't know how much that is, but when I'm done, I'm sure my mom will let me know. That's what I have to do. That's what I was told to do. That's what I did. That family relationship was restored. You know, the family that bailed me out of trouble all those years was restored. I became somebody they no longer had to worry about. That's how I made my living amends to my family. Last year, my mother suffered a stroke that left her paralyzed and unable to walk. I was going through the divorce, and my mom had had a stroke, and I tell you, my life was crumbling around me. But I was connected in this program. I was going to meetings. I had a sponsor. I had people I could call, and I was able to walk through that. And I moved my mom and dad into my house. The guy used to live in a cardboard box, borrow money from his mom and dad, now had a house that he could have his parents stay in. And I had rehab people come and help my mom until she could walk again and talk again. And that's the power of this program. I tell you, nothing gave me greater joy than to be able to do that. I tell you, nothing ever gave me greater joy than to tell them when they moved in that first day that this is my house. And you're going to live, you'll live by my rules. That kind of stuff didn't happen to me when I drank. I don't know about you. I cried for a month when my mom moved in, not because of the stroke she had, but because I was able to do something for them that they had done for me. And I owed it all to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owed it all to what you people had taught me. This was not Mark. This is what you guys had shown me. Alcoholics Anonymous works. It's an awesome, awesome deal. A program that I walked into 10 years ago and felt like it was the bottom of the pit, that I had arrived to a place that I could not stand, had become a place that I was proud to be associated with, proud to be a member of. That relationship with my family is restored today. My mom and dad lived there for 8 or 9 months. My mom got rehabbed. They moved back up to their place, and we're going up to visit her tomorrow to see her. See, I no longer have to be, they no longer have to worry about me. Well, that's not true. I'm their youngest. They're always going to worry about me, but not in the sense of the sleepless nights that I gave my family. You know, we often think when we drink that alcohol doesn't affect anybody but us. I read this to you. Alcohol affects everybody around you that cares about you. And for the last 10 years, I've been working the steps, making amends to my family, to my friends, and to the employers that I stole with. I went back to the companies that I stole money from and made amends. I made amends in person, and I made them financially. And I tell you, I did some jail time because of those things. It wasn't a lot. I got a lot of community service. People in this program helped me walk through that. I had to go back in sobriety and turn myself in for what I had done. Now, you try doing that. That wasn't easy. But that's what I had to do if I wanted to stay sober. I had to take direction from my sponsor. And I turned myself in. And I got sentenced to something like 24 weekends at the Goodwill. And that was hell. I'm telling you. I wished I'd have gone to jail. The last 10 years have been rich and meaningful for me. They really have. Life has happened, both good and bad. Throughout it all, I've managed to stay sober. Have I done it perfectly? Not even close. Have I enjoyed it? Absolutely. I was at dinner tonight with probably 8 or 10 other people. Unique and priceless relationships that I've developed here at Alcoholics Anonymous. I have an awesome life today. I have often thought about my life. When I was a kid growing up, what I wanted it to be, when I had all those things going on good in my life, when high school was great and I had the scholarships and making, you know, the world, everything was possible. And the life I dreamed then isn't even close to the life I have today. I mean, it's not even close. But that life didn't come about because of Mark. It didn't. And in the book, again, one more time, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. I am not responsible for where I am today. I am more than willing to share what I have today with others, because that's what I've been taught in this program. I'm just so grateful that I'm not in a cardboard box anymore, that I have a house to go home to. I have relationships with people that are just amazing. What a great deal this is. What a great deal it is to be sober today. See, I got 10 more minutes to go. Let's see. If you're new here tonight, and I know there's quite a few of you new that are coming to the speaker meetings. Speaker meeting was one of the meetings I liked to come to because I knew there was no chance I was going to get called on. I could actually sit through an hour meeting. I found one that I could go to. That and the woman's meeting. You know, I really want to encourage you to get involved. If this group doesn't turn you on, or if you're just here because this is a place you have to be, find a group that works for you. This one works for me. You know, I've heard some really good stories about Saturday Night Live from other people in other groups, and I'll just share this one that I think is kind of humorous. And those of you that are members might appreciate this one. There's a guy that had lost his wife, and she had left him, and he was at a group crying about it over in Los Gatos. You know, the upscale meetings. It's $5 a meeting over there. It's only $1 here. He said to the guy, he says, well, my wife left me, and I don't know what I'm going to do to get her back. And the guy said, well, is your wife in AA? Well, yeah, she's in AA. Well, what group does she go to? What's her home group? So, well, she goes to Saturday Night Live. Well, Saturday Night Live, you don't have nothing to worry about. The guy looked at him and said, what do you mean I have nothing to worry about? Said, well, you just got to get back in line and wait your turn. It's nice to know that our group is thought of so spiritually over here. The book says we absolutely insist on having fun, that we are not a glum lot. You want a group that has fun and we're not a glum lot, then I suggest you make this your home group. I have had so much fun. There's been times, though, that I was embarrassed to come back here because of my behavior. There's been times that I've done things that I didn't think a sober person should do. But, you know, I did them. And when I walked in, you guys weren't pointing fingers at me, but you had open arms. What an awesome deal. What an awesome deal. We all grow up publicly here. We all know about each other. We all care about each other. We all have a common solution, and it's found in the first 164 pages of the Big Book. And we share it amongst ourselves. We encourage one another, we help one another, and we stand by each other. We all encourage each other to get sponsors and to work the steps. We become accountable to one another. We have fun together. We go on trips. We go to picnics. And then we venture out in the real world and go to jobs and interact with other people. But through it all, we all have that special connection with one another that the book talks about. A connection of people that would not ordinarily mix. And I have found it in these rooms. There are people in here that I would not ordinarily mix with, that I have relationships with that are amazing. I'm really grateful to be here tonight. I'm really grateful for these rooms. And I want to thank Billy D for asking me to speak tonight. With that, I think I'll close. Thank you very much.